copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'm really honored to be asked to speak to you today. The first time I attended ELF was in 2006 in Hungary. And that was in the Apologetics Foundation, or I think it was only about Apologetics Network that time. And I felt so out of place. I was not a theologian, not a teacher, not a philosopher. I had barely read a book. I barely heard about apologetics. And I didn't understand everything, to be honest. But it's at the same time, I felt this need to dive into this and to see how can I use this. I'm never going to be a philosopher. I'm never going to do the important work of high apologetics, as Tim Keller calls it. The arguments from a very academic view. But I am a mother. I meet so many youth. I need to be able to articulate answers to their questions in a way that they will understand. You don't have to spend a lot of time in statistics to know how important that is. So that's what has motivated me. Earlier this week, you heard Lars Dahle speak on Acts 17. Lars is my colleague, or actually he's my boss. And I believe he said something on how Paul used what he saw in the culture to build a bridge for the gospel, searching for points of contact and points of tension. Is it still important to quote the poets? How do we do that today? We're going to see if we can point to a few tools. So are you trying to be relevant? This is a question I've gotten surprisingly many times. Another one is, so you're saying that you have to watch the latest movies to tell people about Jesus. Maybe the question isn't always put just like that, but often with a suspicious tone, implying that I am looking for either one, to watch TV and never say no to anything, or two, watering down the gospel by talking more about the latest TV show and of repentance and salvation, or three, looking for Jesus figures in every story found on a screen, or all of them. And yes, unfortunately, sometimes I do all of these. But at the same time, no, working with the stories told in our culture, it's not about selling the gospel cheap or being relevant in the sense of being fun and relatable and enjoying. It's wisely balancing between adapting and withdrawing as Christians. In the words of Daniel Strange, which has written one of the best books in this area, culture is the stories we tell that express meaning about the world. And culture is, of course, more than screens and books and music, but we are going to narrow the focus in this session. And popular culture expresses meaning with a language that goes straight to the heart. We need to listen and see if these stories are trustworthy. We need to be aware of our own spectacles we see the world through. And we need to quote the poets like Paul. And maybe we can also learn something from popular culture, how we can use the same language to present a better story. We do not need to spend a lot of time reflecting on the ratio between screen time and Bible study time for the regular tween or teen or adult for that sake. The Bono Group has done several surveys on this. And in the report Digital Babylon, they suggest that the ratio for tweens is about 1 to 20. I meet a lot of parents, teachers, pastors, youth workers, who are concerned about the stories young people are connecting to. There's hardly no need for a call to be more worried. But it seems that many have been missing tools for meeting these stories and the underlying values. And at the same time, when I'm saying not being worried, I will also say that sometimes we need to call people to be more focused on what they are actually seeing and not just watching it as entertainment. Walt Mueller is founder of Center for Parent and Youth Understanding. He gave me this picture of the screen as a pulpit when he said, there is a cultural narrative that is catechizing our kids. The classical definition of catechesis is to instruct orally. Traditionally, catechesis in the Christian faith took place in the home and the church, with adults asking students a series of questions about the faith, to which they would memorize and recite answers. Regularity and repetition were employed to make the instruction effective. Today, they are being catechized through regularity and repetition into a series of cultural beliefs that results in behaviors. Now, the picture might not be just as black and white, because parents and significant other role models, schools, are also important in worldview formation. But if the screens are catechizing people, and to be honest, not just young people, we need to look at what they are catechizing them to believe. We need to go under the surface, because no story exists neutrally. It is connected to a worldview. Daniel White Hodge puts it like this in the Barna Group reports. It means doing the difficult work of finding God within the sacred, the profane, and the secular, and in turn developing a missional model of engagement, having the gospel at center for young people immersed in media. Because so many people are searching for answers to deep questions in the stories of popular culture rather than in God's story. They do so out of many different reasons. One of them being the power of the moving image, as stated maybe in fear by a church leader 110 years back. But we need stories in order to make sense of our world and our lives. Folk tradition and official religion used to be the key provider of such stories. But in our media-saturated world, many stories are provided by popular culture. We did a survey at Danmarks Norway talking to young students, where this young girl said, I prefer watching movies and television series that I can relate to, especially when life is tough. She went to the fictional stories, searching for meaning. And stories are a great way to explore existential questions. You have nothing to lose. You can follow a train of thought as far as it may carry you. These stories are vital in worldview formation. And tweens have often made lifelong decisions on faith before they are 12 years old. Do we have a choice in relating to the input they are getting? So what is cultural apologetics, and how does it differ from what we might call traditional apologetics? You might say that the term in itself is rather new, even if apologetics always have had to connect to the culture. Ken Myers offers this definition of cultural apologetics. Traditional apologetics is concerned with making arguments to defend Christian truth claims and has often addressed challenges to Christian belief coming from philosophical and other more intellectual sources. The term cultural apologetics has been used to refer to systematic efforts to advance the plausibility of Christian claims in light of the messages communicated through dominant cultural institutions, including films, popular music, literature, arts, and the mass media. That was a long section. But Tim Keller uses the terms high apologetics and popular apologetics as kind of a boxes to put them in. Justin Ariel Bailey talks about uppercase apologetics. He means approaches that focus on evidences for faith, and lowercase apologetics, approaches concerned with the questions being asked in our context so that Christianity becomes intelligible and plausible. But neither of them replaces or minimizes traditional apologetics. They go together, because both of these perspectives are important. Both operates on a scale from pre-evangelism to evangelism to disciple-making. And some have criticized cultural apologetics for not answering the truth claims of Christianity. To that, we can say yes, maybe sometimes. But it still might be just as functional in answering the feelings behind the questions for truth. Often a story must be met by a better story, not just with arguments alone. And cultural apologetics can draw from the way stories are told to be more effective. And I find them that as a tool to build a bridge for the gospel, cultural apologetics gives so many possibilities, at least where nobody even questions Christian truth claims at all. And also as a parent, helping my children to question the answers the stories are providing has given us so many openings to point out why Christianity is reasonable. Entertainment and popular culture is both reflecting the society and driving it. We know that popular culture has been behind a lot of the changes we have seen in society the latest years. It's kind of hard to point to we have some research, but they are so different. So it's hard to say that these are the questions and these are the answers. This is the way they work. We have quite a lot of research how popular culture are driving the changes in society. One example is support for same-sex marriage. After cratering for a year, how it began to climb toward its now historic height in 2009. I don't know if you remember what TV show appeared in 2009, Modern Family. 2009 was the year that audiences met Cam and Mitch, a gay couple living together with an adopted daughter. A poll from Hollywood Reporter from 2012 found that 27% of likely voters said that depictions of gay characters on TV, like in Modern Family and the hit show Glee, made them more pro-gay marriage. That's just one example. And the assumptions Tim Keller is talking about in this quote affects our whole thinking. And it affects how we are reading the Bible ourselves. And that is just as important to realize for us when communicating the gospel as it is for us to know about those we are trying to reach. It applies both for us and for them. And we often need to go the extra round of pre-evangelism before we even get to the truth claims. So just a quick look at one tool to identify the values that are being presented in the stories we meet. But first, we have to quit thinking that a story is just entertainment. It's never just entertainment. And two, we have to practice how we meet these stories, both with our minds and with our hearts. And remember, we need to meet them with respect for the art and with respect for a holy God at the same time. Don't read into the stories more than what there actually is in it. Learn to read the context of the story. Remember that all art is reflecting that we are created in God's image, but also reflecting the fall. So no, we don't need to know every story. That would put us in danger of resembling Demas, who was so eager to get to know the world that he forgot to protect his art. But this model has been of great help to me. In this slide, I'm referring to the movie Soul. You can easily adapt it to lyrics and TV shows and TikTok stories and so on. Because when we meet a story, we often want to jump straight to assessing it ethically or from a theological point of view. But hold on, let's back up. Our emotions will often lead us into a decision on how we rate a story. Our feelings are easily manipulated, which the creators spend years and big budgets on using. The feelings that are raised in us when relating to a story will have an effect on how we evaluate what is going on, both ethically and theologically. If we feel empathy with a character, it is harder to have a distance to the choices being made. I don't know if you remember the movie Me Before You. A strong example. First, it's based on a book, but do not have the frame to take all the reflections from the book into the movie. So the decisions that are made in the movie comes from no base. The difficult question of euthanasia is done, at least to some extent, it's given more time in the book. And second, the beautiful, expressive Emilia Clarke that can depict a heartbreak with just her eyebrows, and Sam Claflin playing a quadriplegic, which looks like an athlete just landed in a wheelchair a week ago. Soft music, beautiful landscape. It changed the arguments on euthanasia among the non-experts and those having an opinion without being near such situation themselves. Jojo Moyes, the writer of the book, said in defense of the movie that this is not by any means sending out a message. It's just about one character. It's nothing more than that. If you want to, I can add some research when you get the PDF afterwards. Let's just plow through these before the questions. Because aesthetics leads the emotions. Music, lights, colors, angles, all of them uses our longings for resolution, for hope, for reconciliation. And these two first levels, I think as Christians, we often skip them. But they are important when listening to the underlying values and answers, because these two levels are making apologetic arguments for the underlying values and worldviews and defines if we are going to trust them. Then we can go on to looking into the ethical level. What is being considered good and true? What is meaning? What are the solutions and so on? And this thinking in levels has made the whole concept of worldviews more accessible for me, because existentialism, naturalism, postmodernism, it went from theory to be connected to people and stories I felt I knew. And it's only at the fifth level we hold these views against the Christian faith and are looking for points of contact and points of tension. So that was a really, really quick introduction to how we are trying to work. Here are some questions. So it's time for the first breakout. Is the concept of cultural apologetics new to you? That's what we just did with the five levels, is building a bridge to the next tool, which is one of the main areas today. Or more than a tool, it's a way of thinking and maybe also a way of living. And many of you might be familiar with the term double listening and the theologian and author behind it, John Stott. But let's just look into it for a second. There's one time in the late 1960s, John Stott was being approached by a staff member who felt that Stott was not really addressing the concerns of the younger generation and encouraged him to engage more with the wider culture. And Stott started to go into the theater and cinema, practices he had initially renounced as worldly after his conversion. He was not just looking for illustrations for his sermons. He tried to understand and engage in stories, their assumptions and their concerns. So in his own words, Double listening is the faculty of listening to two voices at the same time, the voice of God through scripture and the voices of men and women around us. These voices will often contradict one another, but our purpose in listening to them both is to discover how they relate to each other. Double listening is indispensable to Christian discipleship and Christian mission. He expands on the double several times. It's not just the word and the world. It's a contrast between them. The double refusal, the ancient and the modern, escapism and conformity, and so on. And double listening is not just for preparing a speech. It is a way of living. And the goal is bridge building. Not to merge the word and the world, but to show the world that the word is life itself. To connect the gospel to people's deepest longings and to call to repentance. But stop, you humans. Double listening could have been a sport with a high level of danger. So his double refusal is equally as important. And you find it in the outline. We have to begin with a double refusal. We refuse to become either so absorbed in the word that we escape into it and fail to let it confront the world, or so absorbed in the world that we conform to it and fail to subject it to the judgment of the word. Escapism and conformity are opposite mistakes, but neither is a Christian option. And then he goes on to say, it seems to me that relevant communication grows out of this process of double listening. And then we are back to, so you're trying to be relevant. I wish I'd had John Stott's way of wording the issue. Yes, I am trying to be relevant when relating to popular culture, because the stories are relevant in people's lives. But I try to do it with respect. Stott describes it as critical alertness, anxious to understand it and resolved not necessarily to believe and obey it, but to sympathize with it and to seek grace to discover how the gospel relates to it. And that's a key word, seek grace. Often we as Christians meet these stories not with grace. We might be angry, we might be sad, we might be disappointed, we might be even not caring. How can we meet these stories with grace? Because someone is connecting their heart to these stories, and we need grace to see that. That doesn't mean that we should agree with the story, but be careful of the sounding of the words. What double listening teaches us is that in every cultural manifestation, there's always a point of contact with the true Christ for us to use to lovingly point others to him. Those were the words of Daniel Strange, the book that I read, it's in the blur. You have it in the outline. Daniel Strange plugged in the best book on this. Let's just give a few examples. I have been working with popular TV shows for children and tweens. I found some key trends that is seen in a surprisingly wide range of series and categories. We won't go into all of these now, but just take a few. It's common to find a theme of fighting for a better world. This is speaking directly to the Icon generation, who is a socially conscious, if not more, than its generational predecessors. The problem is that the I generation believes that liking and sharing is working for change. But the question is real. What can we do about evil? And from there, why does a good God allow evil to exist? For these characters, evil is definitely real. They suffer loneliness, abandoned by loved ones, loss. I often think that these series talk more realistically about life than we ever do in church. But the problem is never addressed. The problem of evil is never addressed. It just is. Where does it come from? Nobody knows. What is the solution? It's not said. But the question of evil is important, even for young children. It's the main question why young people are leaving the church. Increasingly more important as they grow. And they meet it in the TV shows as really young children. We have to let them ask the questions. Because struggle and doubt aren't toxic to faith. Silence and lack of trying are. I could go into one of the other, finding your inner hero. Themes like, can we be heroes by listening to ourselves through self-realizations? How can we teach young people about the integration of faith and occupation, helping them understand the concept of calling, emphasizing the meaning and theological significance of work? You see, there are bridges everywhere. And I could have gone into all of these trends. These are just for children's TV shows. In all of these stories, there are traces of worldviews. They might not be consistent, and there might be more than one in the same story and in the same character. Just by watching the way of living, what is going on, what is the story, we can identify underlying views of ethical values, of humanity, of reality and faith. And faith understood as trust and search for meaning. It's like this iceberg. On the surface, you see what's been said and done. Often that's what we are deeming how we like the story from. And values are often quite easy to identify to. What seems to be important and essential, right and wrong, good and evil. Values can often be traced back to differences in the view of humanity, of human value, to the purpose of life, and so on, which then is closely knit to the underlying view of reality. Do we find traces of something outside of ourselves in these stories? Something spiritual? Is it faith? Is it more specifically Christian faith? Is it a blind faith that has nothing to do with truth? Where is meaning coming from? In what do they trust? Science, something spiritual. The questions go on. For me, one of the main questions is to look out for what are they hoping for? Where are they looking for hope in the stories? Is it for being seen? Is it for being acknowledged or loved? Is it peace? Is it fulfilling a dream? And when we have done this train of thought regarding the story we're listening to, we have a better foundation for evaluating the answers the stories provide. Are they trustworthy and reliable? True. And then it is time to see if we are answering the questions our culture are actually asking. It might not be very fruitful to give reasons for God's existence if we haven't asked if God is even in the picture. Let me just give you an example from the light bulb was lit in my head. This was maybe the first time I caught the concept of the iceberg. Friends, Tuesday nights, 9:35. The ones disturbing that time slot needed to pray for mercy. I saw it all. It was, I followed friends and loved it. Every episode and every season. This picture is from the pilot episode for Friends. The very first time we met Rachel Green. Rachel tries to tell her father, who wants her to marry for money and prestige, why she has called the wedding off. She calls him and tries to explain. It is like all my life, everybody keeps telling me that I'm a shoe. But what if I don't want to be a shoe anymore? Maybe I'm a purse or a hat. Oh, I don't want you to buy me a hat. I'm saying I am a hat. It's a metaphor, Daddy. Over the surface, she's saying she wants to start over to live her own life. Values for her seems to be freedom to express herself, to choose. For her father, money, a good name, working to improve your status. Deeper down, the freedom to choose is about identity, to create yourself through the choosing, and to be free to choose again tomorrow. What is my identity rooted in? And is it built on my value or on my appearance? Identity is not something given to us in this series. In that short exchange, Rachel was portraying a form of postmodernism. I need to create myself. My identity is on the outside. She was asking, how can I create a new me? So let's look at a clip. Normally, I would have given you some context for this clip, but to save some time, we're just going to go straight into it. It's a teaser for the Disney Pixar film Soul, where we get to know Joe, who has been waiting for his big break in the music industry his whole life. He is about to make it, but then something dramatic happens. Let's have a look.
Music moves people. I'm Joe. I teach middle school band. Music is life. You just need to know where to look. Though we are parting ways, we still come around to touch eyes again. If love is the foundation, if the purpose be to recycle life, I promise I'll bring us to one. Spend your precious hours doing what will bring out the real you.
Love.
The brilliant, passionate you.
Love, love.
That's ready to contribute something meaningful into this world.
Love.
God, get ready.
Love.
Your life is about to start.
Oh, so I love that movie. Yeah, let's just have a talk in the group. Did you pick up on anything that points to underlying values, worldviews? How did you see the aesthetics, or did you notice any emotions? You want to? Are there anyone that wants to share something? This clip. How would you use it to points of contact and points of tension for the gospel? If you are raising your hand, I'm not sure I can see it.
That's just to come off mute and speak. I'll say one thing on Sophie. I saw this bringing out your inner potential, the inner you, the real you, something like this. And your life is just about to start. It's like everything else was not real. This is now the real you.
I was really gripped by the fact that it was a teacher, a high school teacher, which you could say that's a disaster because that's not relevant to young people or the audience. But actually, a teacher has a world too. And it's an exploration. I thought that was really, really interesting. You know, going into the mind of your teacher, you know, what an exploration.
There was a mention of meaning and the meaning of life, and I think it was linked to one's passion, which is interesting because some people do not feel any passion, but it was kind of stirring this idea that you have to find your passion to have meaning in life, and once you find your passion, you have to stick to it, otherwise your life doesn't really have meaning.
For a second, that sounds really good.
But then,
not.
Perfect. Are there any others? I can share some thoughts if you want to.
I think, at one point he says music is everything or something like that. So I guess... obviously, we think music is a good thing and it comes from God, but we don't think it's everything. So that's like his be all and end all. So there's contact and tension with that, I think.
The other thing I noticed, Anna Sulfried, is the song was about love. I just heard the word love. It's a, like a nice song, but there was also a picture. I haven't seen the film, so, but there are two people, him and someone else. So he also finds love. That seems to be part of his fulfillment, I think, but I'm not sure. I know they were standing on a beach, I think, together,
just,
but I'm not
just
sure.
Just to say that was his mother.
Oh,
but
well,
that can be, you know.
A mother's love is good as well.
Love, yes.
I didn't know that. That's good.
But it is relevant in the movie, actually. Oh. Very much so. Mm. I'm impressed. Very good. Maybe especially about the lyrics, because many times we just, the lyrics go in one ear and out the other. It's just for creating a kind of a sense of the movie. But the lyrics in this clip is actually very, very important. First, you see the warm colors. It's obvious they want us to feel good, to feel relaxed, to feel like everything is all right in the world. There is nothing disturbing. Everything, it's kind of blurry, you see. He's found meaning. He's at peace. But how did he get there? That's the story of the movie, and I'm trying not to spoil it. But it's relatable. It's soothing music. And the music. It came from a man on the train station playing guitar. I don't know if you noticed. That's actually an image of a real artist, Cody Chestnut, his name. And he sings, "Though we are parting ways, we shall come around to touch our eyes again. If love is the foundation, if the purpose be to recycle life, I promise I'll bring us to one beating heart in the end now." It's kind of a confusing lyrics, but he's singing about, I'm guessing we are getting another life. Maybe when we are dead, we're going to meet again. But it seems like he's talking about on this earth. How do we feel about that? And you said talking about love. And then he sings God-given love. Many times he sings talking about love, God-given love in a Pixar movie. That's kind of interesting. And that's not even subtle hint to who has made this movie. The director is defining himself as a Christian. Ethically, the movie is about meaning and purpose. And what this clip is trying to convey is that meaning and purpose is found in daily life, in just the small things, in nature, in a good pizza, in being together. We can confirm a lot of that. We can do, as Leah said, in the Ecclesiastics, how do you say it? In chapter 3, when he says that all gifts are given us from all good gifts are given us from God, and we are supposed to enjoy it, and they are supposed to point us to God. So that's a good argument there. But and identity in this movie, and maybe also you saw a glimpse of it in this clip, is not from looking inside and see how can I find myself. It's about looking, reaching out to others. How can I serve others? We can talk about that. That's part of our purpose here, to serve others and calling. There are a lot to say about how afterlife is presented and pictured in this movie. But in the worldview level, maybe not just from this clip, but it says that we are more than just flesh and blood. We have a soul. The title in itself is a hint. We have a soul. We are more than just flesh and blood. And that's quite amazing, because so many stories says that we are not more than physics. And we have been given gifts. We are created for fellowship with others. We are going to live after we die. But the Christian faith says that we are going to live in a new earth, not in a new dimension. So that's just a few things we could take from this clip. I'll just take one minute to read a statement from one person that I've seen so many people connecting to this movie, depressed young people. The scene where he sees this leaf falling down, the music there is so soothing. You should look it up. There's one guy that wrote, as a depressed college kid who suffers with issues of loneliness, worthlessness, and overall sadness, I really need this in my life. I feel like movies like Soul are the only things that understand what I am going through. And I feel like this song is really emblematic of that. When I saw that silent montage of Joe playing the piano after looking at the things 22 has collected, recollecting that what's important in life is not some ridiculous goal you need to reach, but the small happy moments along the way that you share with yourself and loved ones, made me cry so hard. The meaning of life is that life is the meaning. It's to live our life to its fullest, and I really need this more than ever. It's like Pete Docter, the director, went up to me, gave me a hug, and told me everything is okay. That's quite a statement about the movie and how it's... One more clip, it's maybe even shorter. It's from a Norwegian series, but it's with English subtitles.
Og da er det sånn sjalu.
Hei!
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 Vi lager frokost.
Ja, Nora har lagd pannekaker.
Ja,
skal vi spise?
Ja.
Det ganske bra ut.
Ta pannekaka.
Ja.
Det blir bra da. Da begynner ta da.
Kan du
ta da?
Ja.
Vil du ha ljus, vil du? Sånn!
Bare svørte litt her.
Ja.
Han sender meg... Hæ?
Hva er
det
som kommer ut? Det er masse bra.
Med løsilt i det? Du kan...
Jeg husker ingenting fra i går, ja.
Nei, gjør ingenting. Ja.
Blackouts er Guds måte å fortelle deg at du ikke trenger å bekymre deg for noe, Fille.
Du gjorde ikke noe drøyt, liksom.
Let's stop the clip there. They are talking just further on and finding excuses. Any reflections? I see the time is running, but do you any short reflections on this clip? It's from a series called Shame that went over the whole world. There were millions and millions watching it when it's screened in 2016 to 2018.
I suppose you say how people deal with things that are difficult in their lives, and instead of us confronting it, and we try to find a way to therapeutically deal with it in some way or trivialize it, which is very modern, our culture today. Yeah. But the gospel is strong enough to bear the weight of all the pain, but in a different way. So yeah, it's very, the idea of suffering and pain is a great bridge into people's lives. Yeah, I think that's tremendous.
Yeah. Thank you. That's to the point of this clip. There are so many things we could have said. Something is wrong. Why don't want anyone say, I see your pain. I see that you have something you're carrying. They are just trying to find excuses. There are lots of excuses coming further on in this clip. But meaning is in acceptance, in belonging, in tolerance, not forgiveness. Because what is there to forgive? It's my right to decide what's wrong and what's right. That's the theme throughout this series. There are no wrong. Because what's right and wrong is not objective. There are no objective morals. And here you see the result, because she's carrying shame instead of guilt. And there's no way she can get rid of that guilt and that shame. If she would have said, I did something wrong, can you please forgive me? She could have gotten forgiveness and maybe been better off.